We're going to try and talk a little louder so you can hear us. Now, can you hear us? No? Well, I don't know what the hell to do if you can't hear me now. So, anyway, Rusty's going to try and turn things up without getting feedback. And we're going to try and talk as clearly and as loudly as we can so everybody can hear. All right. Please.
You're welcome. I think just a quick comment. I'm hoping we had the question where all these years later and all this experience with the steps, what do you do now? The man asked over here, he's through the ninth step and would like to maintain the level that he is at, and what do we do to do that and all that? Well, first thing we've learned is we can't do that. That's right. That isn't going to happen, and that's really not what life is about. It's an ongoing thing. And so it just kind of moving on here, I think, I don't know that I specifically talked about it, but I know I had many times am making either a conscious or a semi-conscious review of my first and second steps. And every time I sit down at least once a year to go through the steps again, that's where I start. And I look at that. I'll ask myself if I can drink and take an honest look at that, you know. What kind of power do I really think I have left of my own device? And Bob touched on that as well earlier. So that's a conscious part of my life, constantly looking at the second step, primarily through the bedevilments on page 52 of the book. That has been probably the most useful tool I've had, and taking a quick look to see how I'm doing. You know, how many people out there I'm really not getting along with? Can I control my emotional nature? On Interstate 25 at 7 in the morning. So some things just kind of go on. I was asked out there to tell the story of a little bit. We got this idea to start going through the book and the steps, and we'd gotten this far. We'd read in the book through the third and fourth chapter, and we're beginning in the fifth chapter, and as I recall it, and we got to a place where one of the guys in the group, just before we started to read about the third step prayer, had this idea. And at this point, we had been pretty diligent about going through the book and the step, and Lee had this idea. Lee was a little bitty wise ass, and he was always saying kind of something silly. And I had lunch with him last summer, and I reminded him that I got 6 months of sobriety on him, and but he had this idea that he wanted us to read / pray the third step prayer together, and that the reason he wanted to do it, that he had attended many meetings there for a while, and many of them were on written inventories, on an inventory, and he would ask people after the meeting why they hadn't written an inventory, and many of them told him because they'd not taken the third step yet. And his idea was that, if we all said it together, and then a couple weeks later, somebody would ask him why he hadn't written an inventory yet, and he told him that because he's not taken the third step yet, we could call him a damn liar. And we understood that kind of logic. Up until that point, I kind of remember it was a co-ed group, But by the time we, and I'm not sure why I do that, but it seems like there were some women around, and maybe I was hoping. anyway, we're down to 14 men at that point. And so we had read in the big book and got right up to that step and looked at it. In fact, I think we read through it because there was a line down there at the bottom I've never forgotten that said we might want to discuss this with somebody else before we abandon ourselves utterly to God. Now, utterly, isn't that a great word? If that ain't giving it up, what is? Utterly giving it up. And effectively, we went ahead and did that. Now, speaking for myself, we'd got to that point, and there seemed to be a general agreement that we would stand up and join hands and read/pray the third step prayer together. And so that's what we did. I did it because everybody else did it. I don't know why Bob did it, but that's why I did it, because I didn't want to look stupid. Little image management. And back then, it really wasn't cool for a room full of boys to hold hands. And I was probably more concerned about being seen praying. But we did it. I don't remember anything too exciting about it then and all that. But I do remember the ride home after that meeting. And I remember asking God to please make that prayer real. I said, I can't do this any longer. I can't stand this any longer. God, you've really got to help me out with this. And that was pretty much my experience with that. Had another side experience as a result of that I didn't really know that I was till later on that might have been a part of my third step thing. I don't talk about it much, but within a week or so that night that we did that together, I'm attending a meeting and I'm sitting next to Frank, and it's not a meeting he normally attended. Talking about a guy named Big Frank, and they called him that because he was, by God, big. And he had an attitude, and he was one of those guys that admired to a point, but there was enough from Frank. And I'm sitting next to him, and for some reason after the meeting, we both are still sitting on our chairs. Everybody else had said the Lord's Prayer and moved on, I mentioned to Frank that I thought that he'd just become a human being in my eyes, and I was tired of competing with him, and I didn't really give a shit what he thought about it. And I can't give you the exact words, but for some reason he hadn't got up to leave. He didn't have any reason not to say that. And fortunately, he laughed. And he put his arms around me to hug me, I think. I felt like he was going to crush me. But he hugged me, and we had a big laugh. And I got in the car to go home, and I had one of those experiences where I'm driving home, but my ass is not touching the seat in the car. Julie and I had been married 50 years last year, so. I don't refer to her often as my wife, but that's the Julie I'm talking about, is my wife. I don't talk about the other Julies. So. I get home, and she had wanted to go to an Al-Anon meeting, the girls were young. The oldest was maybe 12 or 13 out there in Littleton, what do you think? And another one a year younger, and another one a few years younger than that. And they'd been put to bed and before Julie left, and I showed up 5 minutes later. And so I'm making rounds to go give each of the girls a kiss goodnight. And the youngest daughter was asleep, which was a miracle. And I went upstairs where the two older girls were, kissed the oldest one goodnight, and went into the middle daughter's room. And she was there crying. She'd already been diagnosed with ulcers as a young child. And, and, And so I went and got her a little milk, I guess, or something for it, and I came up there. And I had been working with a bunch of crazy Christians that had driven me nuts. We had this small office up at 44th across from Lakeside there, and they believed in praying for people that were sick. And I've just been through this and all of that. I'm not open to that yet. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not open to much these people are telling me at all. But I walked it there and I gave her that milk. And I asked Patty if she'd like to pray. I don't know why. It just came up. And she said, please. And so I grabbed her hand with one hand and I put my other hand over on her stomach. And I said a prayer, and I don't know what I said. I have no clue what I said. All I know is when I looked up, Patty was asleep. And I went back downstairs and enjoyed the experience that I'd been having that night. I can't find a better way to explain that. And then flash forward a few months. Many of us learned to make green chili about that same time. And Julie and that's all part of our experience. I mean, we talk about steps, but we can make some, by God, good green if you want. Julie was in fixing dinner and fixing the Mexican food for dinner and all that. And the oldest girl said, what's Patty going to eat? She can't eat that. That'll kill her tummy. And Patty says, no, I don't think so. My tummy hadn't hurt for a long time. So, you know, you kind of put that event with the previous prayer and all of that. And I thought, holy cow. We're talking about some real stuff here. We're talking about some real power here. About that. And it's a power we don't seek. With that. We're in a program. The dilemma with what Bob was talking about, that we can do whatever our dreams are, and that's true. Except there's one little trick, because we're in a program who espouses anonymity. And you think about anonymity as the opposite of seeking power. So we'll just throw that into the mix now. If there ain't no God, you're screwed. It ain't going to happen. So anyway, we said that prayer together, and that was the beginning of my experience around the third step. Many times I have shared that experience over the years, and many times before the groups I take through the book and that sort of thing, get down on our knees and pray the third step prayer, I share that with them. It's just important. And it just is, and it was important to make it a wee thing. And I don't know that everybody has that same experience, but I know just about everybody I've done that with, except one, has stayed sober since that time. And that one was the one when Bob and I are doing that with the other, what would it have been, 12 other guys. With that, only one of them went back out. And he drank and crawled up in the doorway and froze to death. Maybe that's why we're here doing this. We don't know. And then from that, I left there and I had the momentum going, if you will, that I was put in the right place to start on an inventory. But I think I'll give it to you now.
Thank you. I took a third step. Before, actually, I had started working with Don. And when the 75 International came along, I had just taken the third step. And then we stopped that process and went back and did it in the group. But the first time I took the third step, we were reading in the book, and he was real clear about this business about selfishness, self-centeredness that we think is the root of our problem. And he said, he kept telling me that this was about selfishness and dishonesty and resentment and fear. And that's what alcoholism was, and I kept arguing with him because I said, no, it alcoholism's when you got to have something to drink and you get this bottle and you won't put it down. And I said, that's alcoholism. And he said, no, it isn't. It's selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And I'm looking at him, and I remember asking him, is that some kind of Zen thing, or the hell is that? And he said, no, that's what the disease is. And I said, that doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any sense to me. And he said, doesn't have to. And then he read me the third step prayer. And he said, I want you to go home for a week and think about this, and then I want you to come back and sit, get down on your knees and hold hands with me and say that prayer. But I want you to know what it's about. And we read the business about, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. And he said, do you know what that means? And I said, sounds like God can do anything with you that he wants. And he said, right. And he talked to me about relieve me of the bondage of self. And what the bondage itself was, that I was so obsessed with myself that I couldn't even see you. And about how alcoholism is about self-centered fear. And that the best part of that prayer, from my perspective, was take away my difficulties. But then it explains why. See, I thought it was great. Well, yeah, take all that stuff, and then what's the rest of this, that I may better do thy will? I mean, wait a minute. There's a hook in there. Anyway, he sent me home for a week to think about it, and I started thinking about it. That's dangerous. Because all of a sudden I'm going, well, what does he want? I mean, where's he going with that? And, you know, and so am I going to sort of flash forward to some third world country holding a religious tract? And, you know, maybe he's going to make me sick and poor and all this stuff that I don't want to be. So by the time I got back, I was a wreck. And he said, well, are you ready to do your third step? And I said, no. And he said, then I can't help you. And I said, no, I didn't say that. I said I wasn't ready to do it, but I will do it. And so I got down on my knees and held his hands and said the prayer and meant it. I've seen people tell other people that God's a lot more serious about that than we are. We went through this whole thing before I did it, where I was going, he said, why don't you want to take it? And I said, I'm afraid. And he said, why are you afraid? And I said, I got no idea what God's got in mind here. And it looks like he can do anything he wants, and I have no concept of where he's going with that. And I don't want to just sort of free fall into God's will here. And so we said it, and then I got up from this thinking it was a very solemn occasion, and he laughed, which I thought was wholly inappropriate. And I said, what's so funny? And he said, you don't want to give God that kind of power in your life, huh? And I said, no. And he said, "That's too bad. God's got all the power anyway." This is just an exercise in who's God and who's the drunk. I've never regretted doing that. I've done it again yearly ever since then. And at some point, you know, we spend the first parts of our lives thinking this is all about what we can get. We think that the world is some kind of dime store that we can run around and grab everything we can get our hands on and run out the door with it. Okay? And all of a sudden, I found out that this wasn't about grabbing everything you could get. It was about giving everything you could give. And that destroys a lot of old myths about what the purpose of life is. You know, let me say something about going into the third step and what kind of frame of mind you go into the third step with. First time I took it, I went into it with real fear. I was totally afraid of what God was going to do to me. And, you know, I mean, it was like the next day I was afraid to get out of bed. It was just, what's God got in mind here? What have I done? What have I agreed to? Where is this going? That was my experience the first time I took a third step. Over time, it got to be kind of an adventure. Wonder where God's going to take me now. And for a while, for a number of years, it was like agreeing to a mystery trip. You know, it was just like, where's this going? I knew it was going somewhere, I just didn't know where it was. And then today, there's two places in this program where I virtually throw myself at God's feet. I just, you know, when we go into this process, when we go back through the steps, the book says we were reborn. And it's true. You know why I go through inventory once a year? Because I get to the point where I can't stand myself anymore. I don't want to be me. I want God to change me into whatever He's got in mind. And He's always got something better in mind than I do. So when I go into the third step, I virtually throw myself at God's feet without reservation. No reservations. Everything's on the table. And I say that prayer with the intent of allowing God to do virtually anything with me that he's got in mind, which is killing me on the spot. I will take the worst possible scenario and agree to it. Because I don't want to be me anymore. And so I go into the third step and the seventh step today with the idea in mind that whatever I had in mind has no value. That all I want to do is I want to become whatever it is God wants me to do, which is anything. Anything that you can imagine. And that I have put everything on the table and said, have at it, I agree to it. Now the question is, are you willing to do that? And really, it's your choice. I mean, you do whatever you want to do, but my deal today is, I'm either, you know, I just, my ex-wife used to say, why don't you ever have both feet in the door? I was one of those people that was hedging everything in life, including marriage, incidentally. And it used to be of some major concern to my ex-wife that I didn't have both feet in the door. And the reason why I didn't have both feet in the door is what I believed about myself. I couldn't imagine any reasonable, sane, lucid woman being married to me. So I always kept one foot out the door so I could beat them out the door when they were leaving. Okay? And eventually, even though the marriage didn't last forever, I put both feet in the door and said, "I'm here for the duration." And I agree to whatever. And if we got to sit down across the table and negotiate on this marriage, I'm willing to do that, although I would rather be shot. Then they have one of those conversations, which reminds me, I shouldn't even say this, but I will because I do. Why is it that women wait till you're half asleep and in bed at night until they turn around and say, "We need to talk"?
They learn it from their mothers. I don't know.
Well, yeah. And you go, "Huh?" They're going, "We need to talk." And you go, "Why did you wait until now?" You go, "Well, we need to talk." Why can't they do that first thing in the morning? I mean, I'm trying to go to sleep, right? Anyway. with the third step prayer, get both feet in the door. Okay? Get in it for good and all. It's easier to see the power of God when you agree to anything. So that's my experience with the third step today, and that was my experience the first time I took it. At some point, you know, we like to complain about anything. If I didn't have anything to complain about, it wouldn't be much of a day. But the real truth about all this is that we are blessed. And see, the benchmark for how we're doing today isn't yesterday. The benchmark is the day we came through the door. And a lot of us forget that. And we compare today with yesterday instead of the first day that we were sober. And so we get a kind of a skewed view. So the truth is that we are blessed and that we have been given the opportunity to continue our lives on a much more positive basis. And a big part of that is coming to the conclusion that God is the power in the universe. And that personal power is an illusion. There is no personal power. If you think you're powerful, you're blowing smoke up your own ass. If you think you have control of life, you know that my first six inventories were all about control and about the lack of control, and then I found out it was an illusion, that this thing is all managed by God. And the idea that he gave me this little steering wheel on the dash just promotes the illusion. I think I'm steering the car. And I'm not. Okay. So, anyway, thanks.
So do we want to do that? You want to do that? Well, there is some who don't want to. Oh, there is? Okay. I thought I heard a no out there. I was going to give you an out, but I won't now. Why don't we just sit where we are? And for those of you that don't know the third step prayer, feel comfortable to open your books so you can see it. And maybe just hold your neighbor's hand and then we'll just do it together. There's too many of us to do it any other way.
We haven't done this for 34 years.
That's right. God,
I offer myself to thee, to build with me, and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would love. Thy power, thy love, thy way of life, may I do thy will always.
Once every 35 years ain't bad, Bob.
That's the first time I held his hand and said the third step prayer since we did it in 1975. Do you know that I sponsored this guy that was light heavyweight Golden Gloves champion in Colorado? You remember Bill Saul?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Nobody else would work with him. He had a reputation. Even the cops would bring 3-4 squad cars when he was drinking out on East Colfax Avenue in Denver. And he was a terror. He was if he hit you, he'd break 4 or 5 things every time he hit you. And I asked one day, I saw him standing up against the wall at this meeting called Old Kent, and I went up to this guy named Tom, and I said, "What's the story on that guy?" And he said, "Oh, that's Bill."
Bill Saul.
Yeah. And I said, "All right." And he said, "He's crazy, and he is extremely dangerous. He was the Colorado light heavyweight Golden Gloves champion." And I said, "Well, so why didn't anybody talk to him?" And he said, "He hits people easily." So I walked up to him, and he looked at me. He said, "Hi, Bob." And I said, "How you doing?" And he said, "I'm not doing well at all." And I said, "So when are you going to pull your head out of your ass?" And everybody started backing up. And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "You want some help?" And he said, "Yeah, I really need help." And I asked him, same thing that my sponsor had asked me. "Are you willing to sit down with me across from on my kitchen table once a week and start at the beginning of this book and do everything that it suggests?" And he said, "Yeah." Now, the only reason why I brought this up is because when we got to the third step, and he said, "So how do we do that?" And I said, "You're going to get on your knees and hold hands with me." He said, "I'm going to what?" But he did it. And I think he's been sober 30 years. So,
one of the more gentle guys I've ever met.
Yeah. But then he called me one day and he said, when he was in the middle of the steps, he called me one day and he said, "I'm in jail." And I said, "What happened?" And he said, "Well, I was over at this girl's house, and this guy called up, and I answered the phone. And the guy on the other end said, 'Who's this?' And he said, 'It's Bill Saul.' And the guy said, 'What are you doing there?' And he said, 'Well, I'm going to take this lady out to dinner.' And the guy said, 'Well, that's my ex-girlfriend, and you better keep your butt out of there.' And Bill Saul said, 'Well, I'm going to take her out to dinner anyway.' And the guy said, 'I'm going to come over there and kick your ass.'" And Bill said, "Okay." And Bill went out to the curb to greet him. And The guy got out of his car and took one look at Bill Saul and started reaching into his jacket. Oh, too late. Oh, yeah. And Bill hit him, broke his jaw in four different places and knocked a couple of his teeth out, and that's when the police came up. Bill went, the guy, you know, I thought he was reaching for a gun. And they took Bill off and then they released him. But he didn't, he was so embarrassed to call me and tell me that he was in jail once again, even after he got sober and started working the steps. So anyway, that's a story.
One of many.
Yeah. So we ought to talk about inventory.
There was a member of the group that, some of you heard this, I'll make it brief, but there's a member of the group that he and I didn't really like each other much. And given we'd both been raised in the Rockies and there were certain people that didn't really like other people, and it was just part of what you grew up with. And as you got older, you'd go out and fight and then go back in the bar and have a few drinks together and part friends. And nobody ever really got hurt bad, but... next night out, they'd be there with their bunch, and we'd be there with ours, and we'd do it again and do that. And he came from that same kind of background down in Trinidad, Colorado. And it doesn't help that he was a fairly tall, really good-looking Mexican fella. And we just didn't like each other. I remember a time... all the girls are sitting at the table at the York Street group. And Ernie walks in behind me. And one of the girls says, when Ernie walks in, it just takes my breath away. Thought that son of a bitch. That was only one reason I didn't like him. But we kind of had this little competitive thing going on, and one day he disappeared. And you go to the young people's group, and they'd say, "Where's Ernie?" And I'd say, "Don't knock it, he's gone." And I don't know, he was gone for maybe 2 weeks or something like that. And when he came back in, I swear there was something different about him. Remember, like, you look in the eye, and there was somebody home, and I'd never seen anybody there before. And he had something going for him, and I didn't know what it was. And for some reason, as the conversation that went around the room to the meeting, Ernie spoke and said that a few weeks before that, he'd gotten into a beef with his wife, and he'd run away from home, and he'd gone down to a place called Lake Whitney, Texas. And what was in Lake Whiskey was a man named Bob White, who had a huge influence on some of your lives. You don't know that, but... And he was down there, and he used to call Ernie Mac. Don't know where he got it, they'd call him Ernie Mac. And Ernie went down there, and he sat him down. Bob sat him down and showed him how to write an inventory. And so Ernie sat and he wrote this inventory. And after he's done writing the inventory, Bob came out and said, you know, what we ought to do is get on the big boat and go out in the middle of the lake here and do some fishing. And fishing is Ernie's second favorite thing to do. So they get out there in the middle of the lake, and Bob turns the boat off and puts the keys in his pocket and says, "Hey, Ernie, why don't you tell me what's in that inventory?" And Ernie can't swim, so he took a fifth step. Back then, the young people's group, when they'd get together, the sign of the times was the peace sign. So that's what you'd do. You'd walk in, and we were kind of just starting that thing, at least in my case, where you hugged one another. And I always had preferences about who I was going to hug, but... at the end of the meeting and all that, Ernie and I would just give each other the peace sign. And Ernie's missing this finger.
That was just another reason why I didn't like him. But he shared that night about getting in a beef with his bride and leaving, going down there and going right in the inventory, and what had happened to him. But the difference in him was so visible. I can't explain it. Just incredible. He was on fire. He was alive. And just super what I saw happen there. And that happened shortly after we had said the prayer, I think, and I went home and I wrote my first inventory. And I opened the big book, and we really hadn't done much with it yet. And I did, wrote all night that night, and I can't tell you what I found in it. I can tell you I only knew to do three columns and then guess at the stuff on the next page over that later became the fourth column. But as inventories go, it really sucked. As inventories go, all it did was save my ass. I like to tell that story because I like for all of us to be able to sit down and have this kind of insight that we can look back there and see that. I understand how I'm selfish, how I'm self-seeking, how I'm dishonest, how I'm so scared, and all of that, but I don't recall that I did that. I just did with what I had there. And I could only describe the fear as that grinding in my gut, the hole in my belly as the wind blowing through it. And I had learned that that was just fear, and it showed up every time I turned around. It had showed up when I tried to have a conversation and look you in the eye. That drove me nuts. To go to a job interview and not look them in the eye, it's tough to get a job. I don't know why. I had a degree in accounting and I was going to handle their money, but I wouldn't look them in the eye. They didn't think I was the kind of guy they wanted to handle their money. And I took the fifth step with Ernie. I won't go on into that night. But that was my first attempt at inventory. And then later, as we're looking at it, we're looking at it closer. And then I wrote another inventory, and it was a good one. And then I've probably written 40 inventories over the years now, and some have been much better than others. And flash forward real fast, 20 years later. No, 15 years later. I'm 20 years sober. And I'm in real trouble. I'm living in Indianapolis. And I had carried the message we had about sitting down and going through the book together and showing them how to do it. And I'm still writing an inventory every year. I do it generally just about every time I take somebody through the book. I do it with them. And my head got in the wrong place, and I'm behaving badly, about to lose my family, I'm not making a living, everything's going to pop. My friends in AA in Indianapolis are trying to avoid me because they're watching the way I'm living. And not talking to Bob, not talking to my friend Earl, I'm not talking to anybody. I don't want to tell them what a snake I'm being. And I hit the wall, and I called Paul Martin in Chicago, and I met Paul in Denver. He'd come and spoken in Denver a couple of times, and had kind of carried a little bit of conversation with him a couple times over the years, but I called him and asked him if there was any possibility that a 45-year-old alcoholic grandfather with 20 years of sobriety could be going through male menopause. And he said, well, maybe. And he said, but if you review your first three steps and write another inventory and come up here and take some fifth steps and go make your amends, you'll feel better. And so this time I said, I'll do whatever you tell me. And then he said, go do that. I want you up here Friday. So you can give somebody a deadline to finish the damned inventory. And so I went home and I wrote a new inventory, and much to my surprise, it was a pretty big inventory. I think I had more pages of resentment than I'd ever had in a single inventory before. And it was all current stuff. I wasn't rewriting old resentments. Now, what's scary about that is that I ought to be telling you that I can cause as much harm stone sober as I can drinking. And there's no bullshit behind that ever. That's just the fact. That's what I can do. And I went through the fear inventory, and that was all current stuff. And it was bigger than I think any of my previous ones. And then I went all the way back through my life on my conduct inventory, and I looked at that carefully. And I tried to remember everybody involved, and I tried to ask myself the 9 questions around the sex inventory with each one. With that, and it was insightful. It was the first time I ever think that I had a description of what was going on with my self-esteem. If you're as careless as I am, you can write your first 3 columns and say it affects my self-esteem, my ambitions, my personal relations, my sex relations, and all that. And then walk away from it with 1-word descriptions of what it's affecting, and I still don't know any more I did before I wrote those things down. And so I'm coming to learn some things. I'm a slow learner, and once I get it, I got it pretty good. And I'm not, what I'm trying to get across here is all those other inventories did me some good. And I found some good stuff in all of them to help me out with it. I found out where my lies are every time. But this time I really found some lies in what I was like. And it was all about these things I'm talking about. That those moments of peace I would get from sex or putting a little extra money in my pocket whether I deserved it or not. Whatever it was. That had nothing to do with reality. And so I'll tell you more about that later, but those are 2 very important inventories that have taken my life, and because of the timing of them, they're probably my the two I remember most. But I don't know that makes them the most important ones. Never stop. I'm still doing inventories, and real quickly. Paul Martin died last August, and the LaGrange group in LaGrange, Illinois was where he went. And the way those guys and gals in that group get to know each other very much is they're taking each other through the steps, and then when it comes 5th times, they swap 5th steps with each other. Many times. And so that's part of your greeting, if you will, when you come into there. It's not an initiation. It's just, you're welcome there, and you can attend their meeting all you want to and that sort of thing. But you're going to be getting real tired of being told to sit your ass down and go through the steps. They're not real gentle about it. And they'll sit down and explain it to you. But that's how they do. So Paul died this past August. Let me tell you the attitude real quickly of what came from all that group. About 6 months before Paul died, he was living in a retirement center. And he said it was a great place except for all the old people there. He's sitting there reading by the fireplace in there one day when an employee of the place had 2 elderly people and a younger person, and she's taking him on a tour of the place. And she's greeting all the other residents and employees in the places they're going along, and it's kind of chatty. And she looks over and sees Paul sitting by the fireplace there, and she says, "Hi, Paul Martin." And of course, he always had some kind of glib remark that he would pass back, and there'd be a laugh, and they moved on. And then the younger man came back, and he said, "Are you the Paul Martin that knew Bill W.?" And Paul said, "Yes." He says, "How can I help you?" And the kid says, "I'm 4 years sober. I'm here with my parents and I can't get along with them." And Paul says, "Do you have your amends list in your pocket?" And the guy didn't know what he was talking about. And by the time he left there, the guy had been shown how to write an inventory. He had a date and a place to meet with guys to take a fifth step a few days later. And he did. He went ahead and did that. So whatever it was, it couldn't have been too long. A couple, 3 months later, the guy stops by there to see his parents and stops in to see Paul, and he's telling him things are going a lot better. He did have the amends list in his pocket, and he'd made some of them. And so we're coming from the kind of thing that at 62 years of sobriety, thanks, you know, and at 87 years old, you're still doing what it takes to keep your life at the best spiritual level there is. Period. It doesn't stop. But I took this, I took a bunch of fist steps. About 3 weeks ago, I get a call from a guy I'd never met before. He's 39 years old, and he was 65 years old, 39 years sober. And he had been one of Paul's sponsees, but he's been out working around the country. He called me from a little town called Douglas, Wyoming. And, they're not much in Douglas, Wyoming. They're not a damn thing other than one. He called me, and we had a chat, and we're talking. And we decide that after all these years, we'd never met, but we'd been a member of this group and all that. After the second phone call we had, we thought, you know, we're not doing something here. What is it? And Larry said, we haven't swapped fifth steps yet. And so we agreed that the following Wednesday we were going to swap fifth steps and do that again. So I wrote another inventory for that particular event. I don't know how long it's been, but it hasn't been long since I did one before that. Every time I sit down to write inventory, I think, boy, this is going to be quick. Bullshit. It's never quick. But I did that this past Wednesday. Larry and I did that together and all of that. And all of a sudden, our relationship seems to be cooking, and I'm glad to know him. And little Douglas, Wyoming, had an AA group where they didn't even know the numbers, why the numbers were in front of the steps. And there's a second group in Douglas that's been there now since Larry's been there. And I understand there's about 12, 14 people in it. They're in the book, and they're taking steps. Some of them get ready to swap the fifth steps and do those things. So what I do today is part of just simply learning what we did. Inventory is a tool we learn, and we get this terror when we read about what inventory is, and we think, oh, and what I'm telling you is inventory is the easiest part of this deal. Those you've done, isn't it? I mean, you find out what's going wrong, and you get to face it, and that ain't necessarily fun, but don't let the inventory scare you, because there's so much more to it than that. But without the inventory, it ain't going to happen. There. Sorry it took so long.
Good. I used to sell in Wyoming. Jesus. It just, I went through Douglas, and I stopped in this retail store, and Douglas is up by Casper, which probably doesn't tell you any more than you already know. And I was in this retail store talking to the purchasing agent, and I told him I had to go to the next town up north of there, which is a big coal mining area, in Gillette, yeah. And so I said, how do I get up to Gillette? And he said, well, you take the highway out of town north here. And I said, how far is it? And he said, 120 miles. And I said, really, what's between here and there? And he said, 120 miles. And he wasn't kidding. Jesus, the only thing I saw between Douglas and Gillette was a bald eagle sitting on top of a dead antelope. Oh, my. All right. You know, for a guy that grew up in the woods, looking at Wyoming is a bit of a shock. Oh, my. So, I was, you know, one of the things that I'd like to mention at some point here is that we weren't given a choice about whether we did this or not. You know, people go, well, it's, you know, they think it's a smorgasbord or something. And that if we're real alcoholics, that there's some choice in this thing. There's no choice here. I mean, either do it or die from your disease. And in between, if you don't do this, you're going to run around with the same level of insanity that you had before. I have a chance to travel a lot, and I run into people who have been in Alcoholics Anonymous, wouldn't know a step if it fell on them. And they're just as crazy as the day that they came through the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, but God's gracious enough to keep them sober and keep them alive. But I'm convinced that at some point, if people hear the truth about recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, that their chances just ran out. That the grace ends. And then you either do something about your alcoholism or you suffer the consequences. And I've seen that happen again and again and again. And it's a real incentive to get engaged in this recovery process. In addition to, aren't you curious at all? I mean, wouldn't you like to know what life is like if you're living on a spiritual basis and all of a sudden you start to see some of the fruits of living a spiritual life, and are you so convinced that you need to run around trying to grab everything you can get that you're unwilling to take a look at what life can be on a, like on a different basis? I'm amazed that people want to hold on to what they had. You know, I've come to this conclusion that it's this syndrome where we say, well, it may be a pile of shit, but at least it's my pile of shit. Has it ever occurred to you that you may not want to live in that? That there are some choices here, and that all it requires is for us to engage in the process. Well, when I was told in the beginning that there wasn't any space between the third step and taking inventory, and that we launched into this thing, and that, you know, you don't get 2 months off to recuperate, that we start an inventory, and my sponsor had me bring a legal pad with me when I took the third step. So, and the book says that unless it's at once followed by a rigorous attempt to clean the house, it'll have little permanent effect. And it was explained to me that that meant that the third step would wear off if we didn't take inventory. Well, we all have this inclination to avoid looking at ourselves for fear of what we're going to see. And we don't want to go through the experience of finding out that what we were afraid of was real. Although it is. Some of it, anyway. So I started writing this inventory, and I didn't have much of a problem with the grudge list because I pretty much disliked everybody I'd ever met. You know, there's a lot of us running around in Alcoholics Anonymous that just don't like people. We form strong relationships with dogs. Whatever. But, I mean, we are, to some real degree, antisocial. And a lot of that is based on how we see ourselves. You know, if you think that nobody's going to like you, you aren't going to try and join in a relationship with everyone you run into because the end is inevitable. Because you're going to get rejected anyway. So we just go, screw it. You know, you don't get close to anyone. You become loners. One of the enduring character defects with me is that I'm still a loner to some real degree. And I've just never been able to get over that. And it was based on a bunch of silly beliefs that I had never gotten in touch with. So anyway, I started writing inventory. Didn't have any problem with the first three columns in the resentment inventory about people, because that's the way I felt anyway. And then this whole business about, you know, and I could see the things about self-esteem, security, ambitions, personal and sex relations. I didn't have a problem with that. I got it. But when I went back to see where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, that was a bit of a challenge. The real challenge for me was the fear inventory. And I thought I was done at the end of the resentment inventory. And I said, well, I'm done. And he said, no, you're not. And I said, what did I miss here? And he said, the fear inventory. And I said, I think you don't remember what I've explained to you. I'm not afraid of anything. And I reminded him that I had been this 240-pound bill collector in Chicago, and that I used to put people up against the wall and do all kinds of weird things before there were consumer protection laws. I'm who they were trying to protect them from. He said, you're not afraid of anything. And I said, no, I'm not. And he said, well, then the book must be wrong. And I said, why? And he said, well, the book says it's an evil encroaching thread in the fabric of our existence is shot through with it. And I said, mine's not. And he said, well, humor me. And I said, all right. And he said, how about snakes? And I said, what kind of snakes? He went on to point out to me all the things I was afraid of. And by the time I got done writing that inventory, I found out I was afraid of everything. Right. And then we got into sex inventory, and I thought, here's where I'm going to shine. And they had all the wrong questions in there. And it took me 7 years to write an inventory to come to a conclusion about jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness. And I was writing that inventory when I was like 7 years sober, and the light went on. And I found out that I used jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness to keep my partner off balance so they couldn't get a good look at me. You see, what I thought was the same thing I explained to you before, that I could not imagine why any sane, rational woman would have anything to do with me. And so if I was in love with him, I'd keep him off balance, which is frankly counterproductive, so they couldn't get a good look, because I thought they would be, if they ever got a good look at me, they'd be out of there faster than I could spit. And so that was just a belief that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with, something that had been explained to me when I was a kid, that I was no good, I'd never amount to anything, I had no value. And all of a sudden, I'm with someone else that I want to be with, and terribly afraid that they were going to see me the same way those other people had explained who I was. So I kept them off balance, and it was mean. It's one of the meanest things you can do. You know, I'd walked around aloof and said if they didn't like it, there was no anchor on their ass. They could leave any time they wanted. And I was afraid that they would. So I went through this exiumatory, and what happened was I went into that inventory thinking that I was Casanova and came out finding out I was Elmer Fudd. You know, most of you know how to write inventory. You do resentments, and the resentments are people, institutions, and principles. People, everybody knows how to do. Institutions are no mystery. I mean, those are police and courts and schools and all that stuff, or marriage, or whatever. I know almost no people that write about principles. So I'm going to tell you what my experience with that is. And it happened to me when I was 28 years sober. I was doing my 11th step one day, and I was asking God that after 28 years of writing inventory, why I still believed that if you knew me, you wouldn't like me. And why I still believed that I'd never amount to anything when I already had. There's this great disconnect there. I don't think I'm ever going to be a success, and I already was. I was wondering why the only reason I ever saw that any woman would have anything to do with me was that I was able to make a lot of money. I was wondering why I still believed I wasn't good enough. I'd never defined good enough for what. I just believed that I wasn't good enough. I really did believe that I was damaged merchandise. And that I somehow didn't have as much value as other people. And you need to know that I'm a very conservative person. And I don't hear voices. And then I heard one. And I was asking God without any expectation of an answer. I'd never heard anything before. I just figured it was a one-way conversation. And I'm asking God why I still believed all these things about myself when I knew at some level they were all lies. And what I heard was principles. And then I'm getting into what we in Denver had called spiritual make-believe. But I thought I would humor myself. And I said, what's principles got to do with it? Principles are honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, things like that. And what I heard was, no, your principles are those beliefs that are so deeply ingrained in your personality that you won't even challenge them anymore. And one of those beliefs is that if people really knew you, they wouldn't like you. And I said, well, what do I do with it? And they said, put it in the first column. And I'm going, all right. And I actually went and got out a legal pad and put the columns in it and got out my big book, and I'm having this hallucination. And I wrote, if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me, in the first column. And then I said, what are you putting in the second column? And, and what I heard was, look at the top of the second column and answer it yourself. And what it says at the top of the second column in the big book is the cause. So what caused me to believe that from the time I was 10 years old? people compared to me to my father, who was an alcoholic, and my mother, who was in and out of mental institutions. And from the time I was 10 years old, people told me I didn't have a chance in hell of ever becoming anything. That I would spend the rest of my life in a penitentiary or an insane asylum or wind up in an early grave. And that's the reason why I felt that way about myself, that I was some kind of damaged goods and that I could not allow you to get a good look at me. So I wrote, you know, people told me I couldn't amount to anything in the second column. And then I looked in the third column and now I'm starting to get some momentum. And it said, does that affect your self-esteem? Duh. It destroyed my self-esteem. That's why I didn't have any. Does it affect your security? Yeah. I can't ever be secure in anything. Can't be secure in a job, can't be secure in a relationship or a marriage. I can't be secure with anything because if people around me are never going to accept me, more appropriately are going to reject me at some point because they aren't going to like me, then what's the point? I can't ever become secure in anything. How about my ambitions? Okay, why should I have any? If they're never going to go anywhere, I'm just going to be disappointed. Why would I try anything? That's why people like you and I never amount to anything and make that a self-fulfilling prophecy. Does that hurt? You know, people go, why don't you try that? You go, I couldn't pull it off. Yeah. That's your ego talking to you, telling you you can't do anything. Telling you you're not going to amount to anything, that you're not good enough, that you can't get anywhere, that you can't ever realize your dreams, that you can't ever become the person you'd like to be, and you can't ever become the person that God wants you to be. Because we're caught up in the lies and we can't move. Does it affect your personal relations? Yeah, why would I have any? I mean, if they're just not going to like me anyway, I sure as hell am not going to give them the chance. Does it affect your sex relations? Yeah, sex relations are just personal relations on steroids. Is it a lie? Yeah, they're all lies. And here, just for grins, I'll go the rest of the way with you. Here, why is it selfish? Because at some level, I know that it's a lie. But I'm unwilling to go through the work to see what's going on. Because I've believed it for so long, I just soon leave it alone. I don't even want to go delving that deeply into my personality to change the things that are keeping me from becoming the person that I can be. Is it dishonest? Yeah, because it's a lie. Right? Is it self-seeking? Uh-huh. You know why? Because it allows me to be a victim. Because I can say the two greatest lies in the world. Well, that's the way it is. Or, well, that's the way I am. They're both lies. Why am I frightened? Because I think it might be true. And I don't want to. See, the reason why I keep asking myself about... When someone originally told me that inventory was about lies and not about the truth, then I have to go ask, where's the lie? Right. I don't want to live with lies. I don't want to die not knowing as much of the truth as I can. And I sure as hell would like to know all the reasons why I'm not the damaged goods that I think I am. So what's the bottom line to that? The bottom line to that is I am a child of God and an equal to anyone on the face of this planet. No better, no worse, but an equal. And for me to run around for the rest of my life thinking I'm some kind of damaged goods and accepting something less than what I can have is a travesty and an insult to God. God made us with special skills and abilities, and for us to run around during our lives doing this mea culpa, where we say, well, the reason why I just am afraid to go out and engage in life is because I'm not good enough. You know, that is, if that's keeping you from becoming who you can be, shame on you. That's about you. You can find the truth in that by writing inventory, and you can get to the bottom of that and find out that it's all lies and that you don't have to be held back in this life by a bunch of bullshit beliefs about who and what you are that someone told you when you were a kid when they were mad at you. So the real question is, are you willing to work hard enough to rise above what you believe? Because everybody that I've ever met in Alcoholics Anonymous came into this program with a head full of bullshit. And that we have all this stuff floating around between our ears about who and what we are, and it's almost all wrong. So are you willing to find out that you have real value and real skills and real abilities, and that if you're willing to go find them, your whole life will change? Because as soon as you find out that you're not operating in this little narrow range of life, you'll find out that life is open to you. And that you are able to do all kinds of things that you never imagined. And just because you haven't done it doesn't mean you can't do it. And so the real test of sobriety is, are you willing to risk? Are you willing to try things that you've never tried before? Are you willing to step out with the idea that I can really do things in this life that I considered way beyond my abilities? You know, when the Department of Corrections came to me and said, we'd like you to start doing psychiatric care. And my mind is screaming, wait a minute, I'm the guy that had to go to the psychiatrist. And my mind is screaming, who the hell do you think you're talking to? And you know what I said? I said, let me look into it. All right? Because I don't know what I can do. I don't know what I have the capacity to succeed at, because for a big part of my life I was even afraid to try it. And so I said, let me look into it. And I called one of the therapists that works for me and I said, how tough is it to get a psychiatrist in the mix here? And she said, not hard, because they're all angry at managed care and they're not getting paid and a lot of people are dropping out of the industry and all the rest of this. And I said, do you know any psychiatrists? And she said, yeah. And I said, can you give me the phone number? And I called this lady up that's a psychiatrist and I said, hi, I'm Bob Olson and I have this company and we're looking to hire a psychiatrist. Here's what I can pay you per appointment and here's how quickly you'll get paid. And she said, when can I start? And that's how I got in the psychiatry business, all right? Now, you know, I still see myself as this farm kid in Wisconsin running around on a manure spreader. I used to tell my friends...